rain. Look for a high in the upper 30s. The wind from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low around 25. The wind will be out of the northwest from 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, the high 42, the wind from the west at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy. There's a chance of snow or rain tomorrow evening and a chance of snow after midnight. We'll see a low in the upper 20s. The wind will be out of the west from 10 to 15 miles per hour. Saturday, mostly sunny with the high in the upper 30s and the wind from the west at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Saturday night through Sunday night, partly cloudy with lows in the low 20s and the high Sunday around 30. Monday and Monday night, mostly cloudy and not as cool. We'll see a high Monday in the low 40s and a low Monday night in the mid 30s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana were in the 30s. It was cloudy across the region, with many locations reporting light rain and fog. At Rockford, it was cloudy at the top of the hour, 34 degrees. O'Hare reported drizzle and fog and 35. At Bloomington, fog was reported, 33 degrees there. In Mattoon, 34 degrees with a cloudy sky. Cloudy at Carbondale, 40 degrees there. Light rain was reported at South Bend, Lafayette, and Terre Haute at the top of the hour, 34 degrees at South Bend, 36 at Lafayette, 38 degrees at Terre Haute. Indianapolis reported fog and 39 degrees. Willard Airport reported rain at the top of the hour as well as fog. The temperature 34, the dew point 33, the relative humidity 96%, the wind out of the north at 9, the barometric pressure 29.74 and falling. And at 12:39, 33 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Michael Pollan thinks of himself as a writer, a professor, and an eater, but many people would call him a food activist. The author of books including The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food, Pollan is known for his critiques of industrial agriculture and the modern American diet. Pollan spoke recently with St. Louis Public Radio's Veronique LaCapra about his views on food and agriculture, starting with what he sees as a healthy diet.
It's actually pretty simple. Real food, food that has been processed as little as possible. But, you know, whole foods, the kinds of things that your great-grandmother would recognize as food if you showed them to her.
So are you talking about organic food?
If we can afford to, and if we're concerned about the environment, we should eat organic. Organic is more expensive in most cases, and it's important to underscore that you can eat a very healthy diet without eating organic. You know, if you simply get off processed foods and eat more real food, particularly food you cook yourself, whether it's organic or not, you're going to be a lot better off and you're going to be a lot healthier. I think organic is really important if you have young children or if you're nursing or if you're pregnant. I think that's the time where reaching deep into your pocket to buy organic food is probably a good idea.
As you probably know, the agricultural biotechnology company Monsanto is based here in St. Louis.
I've been there to visit them, sure.
All right. And what are your views on genetically modified corn, soybeans, and other crops, or just food in general?
I think so far the promise of biotech has not been realized. When I was in St. Louis back in 1997 or 98, and I had wonderful access to Monsanto and met their scientists and their executives and went and visited quite a few farms that were using their stuff, there was a very exciting picture of what biotech promised in terms of crops that would actually be enhanced nutritionally, crops that would need less inputs of various kinds. And so far, we're still stuck with BT crops and Roundup Ready crops, the same thing we had back then. So I think so far, it's been a lot of overpromising.
Let me ask that question a different way. Do you think genetically modified foods are unhealthy? Do you think we shouldn't be eating them or that they're bad for the environment?
I'm not afraid of eating genetically modified crops. I avoid them only in the sense that I avoid processed food, and that's where most of them show up. So, you know, I don't think that they're evil. I don't think that they're dangerous, or at least we don't know they are. But that said, you know, Monsanto has not been very open about sharing, allowing scientists to study the crops, to really do the long-term feeding studies and long-term environmental impact. And I don't think a lot of consumers realize, but that if you grow Monsanto seeds, you have to sign a contract that makes it impossible to do truly independent research that they don't review on those crops. So I think we need to know more about them. But my biggest objection, I think, so far to genetically modified crops is that they are a Band-Aid on a very broken industrial system of agriculture. They're a way to keep monocultures alive, and monocultures really are the problem in so much of our agriculture.
How would you answer critics who say your writing has crossed the line into advocacy, or maybe put a different way, do you consider yourself a journalist or an activist?
I'm a journalist and an advocate. I think you can do those two things. And I think that it was a difficult line to deal with. But I don't believe there is any conflict between being a journalist and writing as accurately and as fairly as you can do and advancing an agenda. I mean, at this point, it would be coy for me to say I wasn't a critic of industrial agriculture. But anyone who's read my work knows that that criticism is not a pre-existing position. It's something I arrived at through all the time I spent with farmers, all the time I spent with companies like Monsanto. But I feel that I can still write real journalism that's fair, that is accurate, and is ethical in every way, even though, without question, I have a point of view. And I disclose that point of view in my work.
That was food activist and author Michael Pollan speaking with St. Louis Public Radio's Veronique LaCapra. You can hear his past appearances on the WILL program Focus by going to our website, will.illinois.edu, and typing Pollan in the search engine. That's P-O-L-L-A-N. Well, new guidelines announced by the U.S. Department of Agriculture yesterday call for less fat and more fruits in school lunches. In Louisville, Kentucky, the Jefferson County School District lets students help evaluate its healthy food offerings. Devin Ketiyama of member station WFPL has more.
Meet fourth grade food critic Jackson Schleff.
With the spaghetti sauce and the spaghetti, I'd say it does need a little more chunks of vegetable, ones that you can see fairly well.
He's reviewing that school cafeteria standby, spaghetti, but it's spaghetti with healthier ingredients and less salt. Jackson is one of eight students on the Nutrition Advisory Council for Jefferson County Public Schools. The student group meets four times a year to taste new breakfasts and lunch meals. And a bad review from this group is enough to block a new recipe from being served to their schoolmates throughout Louisville, Kentucky. Julia Bauscher is the district's nutrition director. She says having students evaluate changes to the menu has already improved school nutrition. But the problem with the way kids eat, she says, extends beyond the school cafeteria.
It's not just schools that have to change what they're doing. It's our entire community, everyone. Because I can serve them healthy food, and I can only offer healthy choices, whoever defines what that is, because healthy choices are different for different people. But if the kids don't eat it, what have I accomplished?
The federal guidelines announced yesterday call for a gradual reduction in sodium in school meals. Bauscher says even that gradual reduction will be hard to achieve.
American palates are so accustomed to high sodium content that when you lower sodium, students don't like it as much.
And what students don't like, they won't eat. To help introduce students to a variety of foods that are healthy and tasty, Jefferson County brought in a new chef, Jim Whaley.
These are some locally sourced apples, and I'm dehydrating these, and we're going to take these to some of the fresh fruit and vegetable schools and let the students sample another way to eat fresh fruits.
Of course, this isn't the only school district promoting healthy eating and trying to win student approval. The Los Angeles Unified School District recently revamped its menu and made it dramatically healthier. Schools offered meals like vegetable curry and lentil and brown rice cutlets, but thousands of students stopped eating school lunches and gave a thumbs down to many of the new dishes. It's Jim Whaley's job to figure out the best balance between flavor, nutritional value, and the operational demands of serving 90,000 meals daily. It's not easy. For now, there are still some less healthful options on the school menu. And according to our 10-year-old critic, Jackson Schleff, there's no shortage of demand.
The more popular items that I see are in the morning would be the cinnamon rolls, and during the lunchtime, it would be the pizza or the chicken nuggets.
Whaley insists that changing the culinary culture of the cafeteria is possible, He's confident the new spaghetti sauce he's working on, locally sourced, low in sodium and rich in vegetables, will eventually win over his grade school diners. It just may take a while. For NPR News, I'm Devin Kadiyama in Louisville.
Tonight, another Republican debate. In the many debates held so far, the presidential hopefuls have made their marks.
My bold plan of 999.
$10,000 bet?
It's sad that the news media doesn't report accurately how the economy works.
I can't. Sorry. Oops.
How the debates have shaped the GOP field. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the Moscow Festival Ballet, January 24th, 25th, and 26th for enchanting performances of Swan Lake and The Sleeping Beauty. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 26th of January, 2012. It's the birthday of the British playwright Christopher Hampton, born in Fayal in the Azores Archipelago, 1946. He went to Oxford, studied modern languages. He wrote a play, When Did You Last See My Mother?, which was performed at Oxford and made its way to the West End. And at the age of 20, Hampton was the youngest playwright ever to have a play produced on the West End. He continued to write plays. He wrote a comedy called The Philanthropist. Hampton said, I had a conversation with my agent after The Philanthropist. She said, you've got a choice. You can write the same play over and over for the next 30 years, and you'll probably get even better at it. Or you can decide to do something completely different every time. So I said, as a matter of fact, I have started writing a play about the extermination of the Brazilian Indians in the 1960s. And she said, well, that'll do it. He wrote the movie Dangerous Liaisons, also about 20 films that never got produced. He co-wrote the book and lyrics for the musical Sunset Boulevard. He adapted Chekhov's The Seagull for the stage, wrote the screenplay for the film Atonement, adapted from Ian McEwan's novel, and translated several plays by the French playwright Yasmina Reza, including Art and God of Carnage. Christopher Hampton, who said, asking a working writer what he thinks about critics is like asking a lamppost what it feels about dogs. It's the birthday of the songwriter Lucinda Williams, born in Lake Charles, Louisiana, 1953, who said, above all, the listener should be able to understand the poem or the song, not be forced to unravel a complicated, self-indulgent puzzle. Offer your art up to the whole world, not just an elite few. It's the birthday of the science fiction writer Philip Jose Farmer, born in North Terre Haute, Indiana, 1918, grew up in Peoria, was working at a steel mill there. When he wrote his story, The Lovers, about an oppressive 31st century North America in which there is no nudity and human sexuality is highly controlled. Up until then, sex was taboo in science fiction. Most science fiction editors assumed that their audience of adolescent boys would not respond well to it. But the story was published. He got an award for it, quit his job in the steel mill, became a full-time writer. Philip Jose Farmer, who said, imagination is like a muscle. I found out that the more I wrote, the bigger it got. Here's a poem for today by Brad Rieke, entitled The Beautiful Sandwich. She could always make the most beautiful sandwich, laced Swiss cheese sliced crossways folded once, ham in rolls like sleeping bags, turkey piled like shirts, tarragon, oregano, pepper, herb dill mayonnaise the color of skin, on top the thin wandering line of mustard like a contour on a map in a thin flat drawer or a single lost vein, the poppy seeds hold on for now. Placed on the plate like isolated driftwood, or a large, solemn head. The spilled chips in yellow piles are like the strange coins of tall, awkward islanders. The thin dill pickle, their boat, slides into the green, sour sea. The Beautiful Sandwich by Brad Rieke from American Mastodon, published by Black Lawrence Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 12:53. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Radio.